mutiny and failed. The captain decided to follow up on the deal with the pirates anyway. The better money. Allegedly. Huh. Kiva turned back to Donner. One less option for you, then. Lady Kiva, I can offer you 3 million marks for passage. With the 4 million marks you already require, that's more than half of what I have. Then I guess you're leaving your servants behind, Kiva said. Unless you were planning to take one and leave your mother-in-law behind. The color began to drain from Donner's face again. You were, Kiva crowed. You were going to ditch your mother-in-law. You utter dog. I was not, Donner protested weakly. A word of advice for you, Donner. With that face of yours, you shouldn't play cards with anyone on this ship. You'll end up in debt. So, we're up to 7 million marks. You planning on bringing anything with you? Any cargo? If you'll allow it, ma'am. Of course I'll allow it. 1,000 marks a kilo, and I'll collect 500,000 marks up front to allocate the cargo space. Any mass allowance you don't use, we'll refund. Donner had learned by this point not to argue. Yes, ma'am. She pointed to Magnute. Gazin will collect before you leave here and otherwise make arrangements. All of it, in full. We depart in 5 days. Gazin will give you the exact time. If you and your family aren't on the ship 12 hours prior to that moment, you all stay here and we keep the money. Do you understand? Yes, ma'am. Then we're done. Go back to the floor of the hold and wait there for Gazin. Donner bowed and left. Magnute closed the door behind him. That was impressive, ma'am, he said to Kiva after Donner was back on the hold floor. Kiva snorted again. Then, what did we learn here today, Gazin? That Severin Donner really wants off the planet? We learned that he wants off the planet badly enough to pay 7.5 million marks for it, Kiva said. And that means there are other people like him who are willing to pay just as much as he is, if not more so. Are you thinking of taking on more refugees, ma'am? Refugees? No. Exiles? Yes. There's a difference? Roughly 500,000 marks per head, Gazin. Ah, so we are running a cruise line then. Kiva smirked and pointed down at Donner, standing forlornly once more near a stack of Haverfruit crates. We just bagged 7.5 million marks off this one dumb bastard, she said. That's 12.5% of our financial loss for this entire fucking trip erased. A few more like him, and we'll actually make it into the black. That's worth putting up with their entitled asses for a few months. Magnute motioned toward Donner with his head. That one's actually got travel documents for his family and servants. Not everyone who wants to go with us and can afford it will have those documents. Even if they were allowed to leave, most government offices are closed, so they wouldn't be able to get them. This is our problem? When we get to Hub and unload these exiles, if they don't have travel documents, we can get fined for illegal conveyance. So, yes, it could be our problem. We can only be fined if they can prove we knew they weren't allowed to travel, right? Sort of, Magnute said. It's more complicated than that. But basically, Kiva said, if they have travel documents and they just happen to turn out to be fake, but we weren't able to tell, then the House can probably get those fines dismissed. Yes, ma'am. Kiva raised her eyebrows, signaling to Magnute without incriminating words ever being spoken that he should find and procure the services of someone who could make passable faked travel documents on an expedited basis to make sure these forgers charged an outrageous amount for them, of which the House of Lagos would take a finder's fee cut, and that, of course, if the forged documents were ever to be traced back to them, Magnute himself would take the fall rather than implicate Kiva and, by extension, the House of Lagos. Magnute's heavy sigh and curt nod signaled that he understood this perfectly well. Then, send out the word that we're accepting exiles. If they want on the ship, they better hurry. And they better bring cash. A lot of exiles did want on the ship, and they were happy to bring cash. Not all of them were the financial windfall of Severin Donor, of course. Not everyone was planning to bring a family of five with hangers-on. But they added up. The single exiles, the couples, and occasional families of three or four, all at 500,000 marks ahead, plus cargo charges, plus documents, plus additional sums if the refugees were Lagos franchisees or business associates, which many were, because Kiva told Magnu to screen for those and to give them preferential treatment. Within 2 days, Kiva was within 5,000,000 marks of going into the black for the trip. "I'm a fucking financial genius," she said to Captain Blanika back on the Yes Sir. "Or you're war profiteering," Blanika said. "I'm not selling anything to the combatants," Kiva said, taken aback, but then trying to shrug it off with some light snark. "I'm offering a service to those who wish to leave the theater of combat. That makes me a humanitarian, actually. I'm saving people." "For 500,000 marks each."
"I didn't say I was a bleeding heart about it."
"Whatever you say." "We might finish this trip making a profit," Kiva pointed out. "You don't object to that?"
"No," Blanika admitted. "Even a small loss will be a win for us, given the circumstances. I won't lose my command, you won't lose face in front of your mother and the House of Lagos. What you're doing makes sound financial sense."
"But?" "There's no but. You're right. It's just a reminder that war favors the rich. The ones who can leave do. The ones who can't suffer." Kiva was silent for a moment. Then,
"Fuck you for having a conscience, Tomi."
"Yes, ma'am."
Kiva's tablet pinged. It was Gazin Magnute.
"You're about to have a visitor," he said when Kiva connected.
"Who is it?"
"A Lord Grenny Nohama Peaton.
He says you know him."
"Oh, for fuck's sake," Kiva said. "What does that abject pile of shit want?"
"I think it has something to do with your exile plan. He was asking questions about it, anyway."
"And what did you tell him?"
"I told him that he would need to bring it up with you. He got snitty about it and tried to pull rank with me, at which point I began quoting interdependency trade regulations at him until he got frustrated and left me alone. He turned to his flunky and told her to get him a shuttle to take him to the Yes Sir. He'll be there presently."
"Got it," Kiva said, and closed the connection.
She turned to the captain. "Ready to do some space lawyering?" Blanika smiled.
"Of course."
"Good, let's go."
"Lady Kiva," Grenny Nohama Peaton said, once the shuttle bay had run through its cycle and put air back into the space. "So lovely to see you again."
"Is it?" Kiva said.
"As far as you know, yes."
Grenny nodded to the captain.
"You are Captain Blanika, I assume."
"Yes, my lord."
Blanika bowed. Grenny did a quick head bow in return and then focused on Kiva.
"We should talk privately," he said.
"About what?"
"About your profit-taking on refugees."
"There's nothing to talk about."
"The Duke disagrees."
"Captain?" Kiva said to Blanika.
"My lord, the interdependency is quite clear on the rights of refugees during wartime and the leeway ships and their crew have in offering assistance to them. Indeed, it's one of the core rights of the interdependency, handed down by the Prophet herself."
Granny gave a humorless smile to this.
"That's a lovely sentiment, Captain. Obviated by the fact that you're charging 500,000 marks ahead for passage."
"Actually, the captain and I were just talking about the plight of the less advantaged," Kiva said.
"Hugh?" Granny said, disbelieving.
"One, fuck you, and two, yes."
Kiva looked over to Blanika. "Isn't that right?"
"There had been some discussion, yes."
"And I suppose now you're going to tell me that you charging 500,000 ahead to leave end is meant to subsidize the poor you will also take on as a gesture of your concern for their plight."
"Maybe. I suppose that's hard for you to believe, Granny, but then you've always been a condescending little shit."
"There was a time when you saw that as an endearing quality, Lady Kiva,"
Granny turned his attention to the captain.
Laws concerning refugees notwithstanding, you are aware that End has special status in the Interdependency. Many people here can't just leave. They are here on End for a reason.
Our Chief Purser is well aware of the special nature of End and some of its citizens, Blinica said. We won't take anyone from the planet who is not allowed to leave.
You don't mind if we double-check that, Granny said.
Of course not, Blinica said. I am sure the Imperial Customs Office here on End will supply you whatever information you desire.
The Duke would prefer to examine your passenger manifest directly.
Blinica shook his head.
Apologies, my lord, but by interdependency regulation, that information must come through a request to the customs office, not from the ship directly.
Surely you may accommodate the Duke as a courtesy.
Are you asking my captain to go against interdependency law? Kiva said.
There is substantial overlap between the Duke's interest and interdependency law,
as I am well fucking aware, thanks to your Duke's embargo of my cargo. But in this case, there's not, is there, Captain?
No, my lady, Linica said.
Well, then. Kiva looked at Granny steadily.
As long as I'm here, I would love to see some of the ship, Granny said after a moment.
You want a fucking tour, Kiva said.
If you wouldn't mind.
Because 3 days out from departure, we don't have better things to do than indulge your whims.
You really don't.
This is your subtle attempt to talk with me alone, yes?
Granny held his hands open as if to say, you got me.
Kiva nodded and turned to Blinica. I'm taking him to the production floor. If I need you again to spout Imperial law at him, I'll call.
Blinica nodded and left.
Come on, let's get this over with. Kiva said, and motioned to Granny to follow her. The shuttle bay was at the aft of the main body of the Yes Sir, a long, segmented needle, off from which branched two separate rings, which held the farming and processing modules, among others. Each rotated to provide a baseline 0.5 standard G with push fields employed to bring the internal effective gravity to 1G. Variations could be employed within individual modules and areas for production and other purposes. As Granny noted when they entered an agricultural module.
I'm bouncier in here.
Kiva nodded. Haverfruit grow best at 0.8 G, so that's what these modules are kept at.
End is slightly over 1 G.
Were you going to tell the people you licensed to about that? It's not like it won't grow at that gravity, Kiva said. It'll grow just fine, and they'd be growing them off of actual haverfruit bushes rather than the hydroponic setup we're using here. She motioned to the growing racks, densely packed with lights and fruits arising out of the growth medium. If you have anything on End, it's acreage. Not that it matters, thanks to the fucking Duke.
To be fair, the House of Lagos let loose a virus that wiped out a staple crop.
To be fair, you can go fuck yourself, because we had nothing to do with that, and you know it.
I've missed you, Kiva. You and your marvelous way with the word fuck.
No, you haven't, but thank you anyway.
Granny motioned to the haverfruit. So, what will you do with all of this?
Follow me to the next module and find out. The next ring module was a processing module, set to 1.1G for efficiency.
You're juicing them, Granny said, looking.
Kiva nodded. Juicing, concentrating, making fruit paste from the remains, all that shit. Not that we'll be able to do much with them directly. It doesn't make sense for us to compete against our franchisees. We thought about it, but we'd just make them upset. So when I get back to Hub, we'll see if we can sell it as surplus to the Imperial government. They'll distribute it as part of their food assistance to poor families or whatever, and the House of Lagos will get a tax deduction.
So you'll finish the trip just fine, is what you're saying.
It's a maybe. If the Imperial government doesn't shove this shit into its food assistance program, we're on the hook for all of it.
I'm sure the Lagos accountants are clever enough to find a way to bury the loss. Combine that with the extortion you're wrenching out from the people trying to leave End, you might even eke out a profit.
You make it sound like a bad thing.
Not at all. What are the guild houses if they don't make money?
That is their point.
Your point.
My point. You haven't actually come to your point yet, Kiva said.
Then here's my point, Kiva. The Duke is concerned about some of the people you might be transporting off the planet.
Okay, so what?
Some of them are people who are of interest to the Duke, for various reasons.
This is where I say so what again.
So, if certain people try to buy passage from you, the Duke wants to know.
Kiva laughed at this. You have to be fucking kidding me, Granny. The Duke is the reason I'm resorting to making fruit paste and taking on rich assholes as cargo.
The Duke asks it as a favor, one noble to another.
The Duke can fuck himself with a loaded shotgun.
Granny nodded again. I thought you might say that. So I've also been authorized to offer you a bribe.
For what?
For letting us know if certain people try to book passage on your ship, and for telling us where to find them if they do.
I'm asking for a lot of money for passage, Kiva said.
The Duke is willing to match what you're charging as the reward.
Match? Hell! If he wants my cooperation, it starts at 2 million marks per person.
That doesn't strike you as perhaps a lot to ask.
The Duke screwed me out of 60 million marks at least, so no, in fact, it doesn't strike me as a lot to ask.
1 million marks per person.
Look at you, Granny, acting like I actually need something from you.
The Duke could decide to make your departure difficult. Is he going to have my captain arrested, like he did with the Tell Me Another One?
You heard about that. Space is a small town. We've already received our clearances, Granny. Our departure's already been approved, and the Duke already has his hands full with not being deposed and probably killed.
1.5 million marks per person.
2.5 million marks, and every time you try to negotiate the price from here on out, the price goes up.
The Duke is not made of money.
Maybe he can just borrow some out of the money of mine he's appropriated, the son of a bitch.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Fuck you! Now it's up to 3 million marks just because you're pissing me off.
Granny held up his hands placatingly.
Kiva, stop.
We have a deal.
3 million per.
Yes.
You'll put 10 million in escrow right now, so I know you won't fuck me.
I'll do it the minute I get back on Imperial Station.
Who are you looking for?
The Count of Clermont and either of his children.
Kids?
The children?
No.
They're both about 30 standard. Twins. One male and one female.
Why do you want them?
I'll tell you. For 3 million marks.
Don't be an asshole.
It's not important. What is important is that we know if any of them try to leave the planet.
If they try to contact us, then what?
Then you contact me, and we'll come in and collect them from Imperial Station, just before they try to board the Yes Sir.
So you'll take care of all of it?
Yes.
You gonna shove them down a well or something?
I don't think you need to worry about that.
I may be an asshole, Granny, but I don't want to be an active accomplice to murder.
We have no plans to murder anyone. We just don't want them to go.
Anyone else? I mean, as long as you're offering 3 million per.
No, but I admire the flexibility of your moral grounding.
You said it yourself. Who are we if we're not making money?
As Granny left the Yes Sir, Kiva pinged Gazan Magnoot.
I need you to do something for me. We have quite a lot of things to take care of at the moment, ma'am. This was, Kiva knew, as close to fuck you I'm busy as Magnoot was ever going to get. Yes, I know, but this is a thing that needs doing.
What is it?
I need you to get someone to discreetly, as in actually fucking discreetly, not just saying the word, to tell me who the Count of Clermont is and why the Duke would give a shit about him in any way. The Count's children, too.
Yes, ma'am.
The time frame on this? An hour ago would be great.
Understood.
And while you're at it, get someone to tell me why the hell Granny Nohama Peaton is on this planet and what his relationship is with the Duke.
We already know he's an advisor.
Right, and I know that twice in the last 3 days, his ass has been the one crossing my path on matters involving the Duke. And maybe you see that shit as coincidence, but I don't.
The same time frame, ma'am?
Yes. That will take money. Spend it.
How much?
Whatever it costs. Tack it onto the boarding price of the next person who wants passage.
Yes, ma'am.
Kiva punched out of the conversation and used her tablet to access one of the Yes Sir's external cameras, right outside the shuttle bay. Granny Nohama Peaton's shuttle was receding into the distance toward the Imperial Station.
What are you up to, you motherfucker? Kiva said out loud to herself. And what is your family up to? Because whatever Granny was up to, it was just part of some larger Nohama Peaton plan. And whatever those assholes were up to, it was no good for anyone else, including the House of Lagos, or the Imperial House of Wu, for that matter, or the interdependency as a whole, come to think of it. Kiva looked at that shuttle, a speck now, and wondered whether she shouldn't just order the Yes Sir's defensive grid to launch a missile into it. Yes, there would be explaining to do. Yes, technically it would be murder. Yes, it would probably start a war between the House of Lagos and the House of Nohama Peaton, which the House of Lagos, for all its power, would probably lose in the long run. On the other hand, at this very moment, it would make Kiva feel really good. Kiva reluctantly put down her tablet and decided to do something else with her time, a decision, by her own admission, that she would later come to regret.
Chapter 6. The coronation robes were heavy. The anointing oil smelled like it had gone bad a century ago. The crown dug into her forehead and chafed. She was sweating. The coronational liturgy was nearly an hour long. And to top it all off, Cardenia's period had begun last night. And right now, her cramps were like someone with an iron glove had taken it, wrapped it around her uterus, and squeezed. Yes, Coronation Day was going along just great for Emperor Greyland II. Thanks for asking. The cathedral in Xi'an, her cathedral in point of fact, because in addition to being Emperor, she was the head of the interdependent church, technically the cardinal of Xi'an and Hub, and thus had to have her own cathedral, was a vast space, made of stone and glass in the early interdependent style. Cardenia mused on the incongruity of a massive edifice of stone constructed inside of a space station, but not for too long, lest the incongruity of Xi'an entire, with its hills, streams, and forests, with administrative buildings, housing corridors, and commerce artfully tucked away to avoid the impression of clutter, send her into delirious giggles. Xi'an Cathedral had room for thousands in its pews, and today, of all days, those pews were filled. Representatives from all of the interdependent states, guild families, celebrities, and princes of the interdependent church looked on, presumably reverently, as Archbishop Gunda Corbijn droned through the liturgy. At one point, Cardenia noted that Corbijn had a speaker set into her left ear canal, revealing that even the archbishop couldn't be relied upon to know the entire ceremony by heart. This relieved Cardenia somewhat, and made everything slightly more human-scaled. Cardenia did not herself have a speaker in her ear, but then her role in the event was oddly limited. Walk and sit. She had processed down the nave of Xi'an Cathedral in a relatively simple imperial green suit, stopped at the transept, and waited for Corbijn to offer her opening prayer and homily, and her invitation for Cardenia, for Greyland II, rather, to join her on the chancel. A stool for kneeling had been set in its center, above a mosaic of the imperial seal. Cardenia kneeled, bowed her head, and waited for things to be put on her by Corbijn and her assistants. First, the aforementioned anointing oil, which almost made her gag with its smell.
Then, a ceremonial scarlet robe and a golden braid with a medallion, the braid being the symbol of the interdependent church, and medallion featuring a phoenix, the personal symbol of the prophet. With that, she was declared the cardinal of Xian and Hub, and thus the head of the interdependent church. Next came a key on a smaller golden chain, symbolizing access to the rooms of parliament, which resided at the other end of Xian from the imperial palace, symbolizing, in theory, if not always in practice, the independence of the parliament from the emperor. This independence was in part belied by the fact that the emperor was always the minister of parliament for Xian, a seat that was generally considered honorary and ceremonial, but which in fact had the same voting privileges as any other. It was tradition for the emperor to abstain from voting on any legislation, including legislation they were known to favor. Legislation they disliked, they would simply veto. But every once in a while, an emperor would record a vote, to the scandal of the rank-and-file parliamentarians. After the key came a signet ring, the size of a small rock, which symbolized Cardinia's ascendance to the role of matriarch of the House of Wu. This was a role formally separate from Cardinia's role as emperor. While the House of Wu was the imperial dynasty, it was also a guild family, with monopolies on starship construction and military weaponry and services. One could very easily say that the House of Wu was the imperial house because of these particular monopolies. As emperor, Cardinia would not be actively involved in the day-to-day running of the house monopolies. Those would be administered by a board of cousins who would resent her interference. But she was the one with the Wu signet nonetheless, worn on the left hand, to leave room for the imperial signet on the right. Which came next? A ring even larger than the one for the House of Wu, along with a ceremonial scepter tipped with an emerald the size of a fist, and a crown of rubies, diamonds, and emeralds, signifying the church, the parliament, and the imperial house, which was heavy as hell and which started chafing Cardinia almost immediately. The scepter, crown, and signet also marked her as Queen of Hub and the Associated Nations, a lesser title. Cardinia also held dukedoms and earldoms and a few baronies, which were salted away among the various interdependent states, which she would almost have nothing ever to do with directly. For each step, Corbine said something ceremonial, said more as she was laying the object on Cardinia, and even more afterward, followed by a prayer or small homily, or both. After a certain early point, Cardinia, sweating and cramping, started wishing that she could have just filed a form. Corbine turned and looked directly at Cardinia, and now, finally, she was required to do something besides kneel there.
"Arise, Greyland II, Emperor of the Holy Empire of the Interdependent States and Mercantile Guilds, Queen of Hub and Associated Nations, Head of the Interdependent Church, Successor to Earth, and Mother of All, 88th Emperor of the House of Wu, and proclaim your reign," Corbine said, and then stood aside.
Cardinia took a breath and rose, using the scepter briefly to stabilize herself, the first and possibly last time the scepter would offer any practical use. Upon the completion of the ceremony, all the accoutrements of the coronation would be, thankfully, stripped off her and sent back into their storage vault, to await the next coronation of the next emperor, whomever they might be. But for now, they lay heavy on her. "That's not at all symbolic," she thought. She turned to face the assembly of nobles, notables, and representatives. The executive committee, save Corbine, in the front row of pews. Behind them, representatives from the House of Wu, and among them, looking wildly out of place, her uncle Brendan Patrick, and her cousins Moira and Justin, representing her mother. Hannah Patrick would not hear of her daughter's ascendance for weeks, and would hear it simultaneously to the news of her enlargement to become Baroness of Takwa Rambeau, a courtesy title from one of the Emperor's own holdings. This title would probably simultaneously annoy and tickle her mother. Several rows back sat Nafa Dolg with her family of Republicans. Cardenia was touched that despite their opposition to imperial rule in a general sense, they still came out to support her and their daughter. Between Nafa's row and the close pews with the Woos sat the matriarchs and patriarchs of various guild families, nobles all. And, in the third row, Amit and Nadashe Nohamapitan, both of them staring fixedly at Cardenia as if she were a long-term project or a side of meat. Or both, Cardenia thought. Behind her, Archbishop Corbine cleared her throat quietly, as if to say, "Get on with it." "I, Cardenia Wu Patrick, having accepted these instruments of church and state, as is my right, become Greyland the Second, Emperor, Queen, Head of Church, Successor to Earth, and Mother to all. May the tenets of interdependency, laid forth by the Prophet, bring continued peace and prosperity to all." "Long live the Emperor!" came the reply from the first pew to the rafters, followed by immense cheering, which Cardenia, through the sweat and cramps, still managed to enjoy. Music swelled. The March of the Prophetess by Hygeliac, written in the 3rd century FI, swelled, performed by a chamber orchestra cleverly hidden in one of the transept alcoves in order to allow more pews to be placed in the cathedral. The boxed-up orchestra had its efforts played through speakers. The coronation audience stood, still cheering, as Greyland II took her first steps down from the chancel, down the nave, and quickly down a side corridor, where assistants were waiting to escort her to a small office to divest her of crown, scepter, and other nonsense, and the imperial bodyguards to post themselves by the door. "I thought that went well, Your Majesty," Nafa said to her. Cardenia looked up, confused, as she was being stripped down. "I just saw you in the audience." "That's because I was just in the audience." "How did you get here so quickly?" "Because it's my job," Nafa said, and magically a clipboard appeared. "How are you doing?" "Tell me I never have to do this again." "It's exceedingly rare for an emperor to have two coronation ceremonies. So yes, you will never have to do this again. Now tell me I can go home." "As the emperor owns Xi'an itself, technically speaking, you are home." "There's a terrifying thought." "In more prosaic fashion, however, you may not go home yet. In the next 10 minutes, you must change into the formal uniform Dokai here is now showing you." Nafa nodded toward the assistant, who indeed had a very formal uniform at the ready. "And then you must go to the presentation balcony to wave to the tens of thousands of people who are currently ruining the lawn of the cathedral in the hope of seeing you. You will be up there for 5 minutes, and then we go back to the palace, where you will have an hour's worth of 5-minute audiences with a minute between them, and another hour of 10-minute audiences with 2 minutes between them. Then you are to arrive at your coronation celebration, at which point you will give a short address," Cardenia groaned, "which I have already prepared for you and which no one will listen to anyway because it is not of consequence. And then for the rest of your celebration, you'll spend 3 hours in a receiving line, shaking hands and having pictures and video taken with everyone, which I suspect is exactly the hell you imagine it will be. Then, and only then, will you be able to relax and eat something. So, I suggest that while Dokai here helps you into that new uniform, that you also eat the protein bars she has for you, and maybe drink some water." "Do I get to relieve myself?" "There's a lavatory here, door to your left. Before you ask, it's stocked with everything you need at the moment." "Thank you. I'm glad someone remembers I am still actually a human." "Of course. Take your time, as long as your time is under a minute." Cardenia groaned again and headed toward the lavatory. 7 minutes later, Cardenia's coronation outfit was packed, her post-coronation outfit was on and surprisingly comfortable, and her phalanx of bodyguards was surrounding her in the elevator, taking her up to the cathedral's observatory deck, where her presentation balcony awaited. Cardenia looked around her and realized that, outside of the palace itself, she was never likely to be alone in an elevator ever again. The elevator door opened, and there was Nafa, again, standing in front of the alcove that was the presentation balcony.
"You have to stop doing that," Cardenia said. "It's creepy."
"Relax. I took up the elevator on the other side. It has its own set of bodyguards."
"Welcome to my world."
"I've been in it a while. I hope you noticed." Cardenia laughed, stepped to exit the elevator, and then was knocked back into the elevator as the presentation balcony exploded. She was unconscious before her body slammed into the elevator's back wall.
There's a very real possibility that the flow streams that connect the interdependency will collapse during your reign. Ottavio VI, Cardenia's father, or rather the computer projection of him, said to Cardenia in her dream. Cardenia was aware she was dreaming. Cardenia was also aware that the dream was, for the moment at least, replaying her first conversation in the memory room. She was not aware of how or when it was that she fell asleep, and the part of her brain that was lucid enough to register that she was in a dream was strongly shying away from thinking about it that much.
"Go with this conversation. It's safe,"
that part of her brain seemed to be saying. So Cardenia did, saying her part of the conversation again, as if reading off a script.
"How will that happen?" Cardenia asked.
"I'm not a scientist," Ottavio VI said. "But the Count of Clermont is. He's been collecting data for 3 decades now. He sends me updates from time to time. The data he's collected suggests that the stability of the flow is an illusion, and that, over a long enough time scale, everything shifts, and that we're about to enter a period of shifts. He says it's already been happening slowly, and it's about to start happening very quickly indeed. It's happened before.
To Dalla Sisla, when the first Greyland was Emperor."
Ottavio VI nodded. "Yes, she was given information, just like I have been given information. Information you'll now have access to."
"She had information, but why didn't she act on it? If she knew they were about to lose the stream to Dalla Sisla, why didn't she do something about it?"
"I could tell you, but you can ask her yourself."
Cardenia blinked at this.
"She's in here?"
"Of course."
"She was lost in the flow. I didn't think she existed."
"She updated before her final trip. Everything but those last few days is in here."
This took Cardenia aback. On one hand, it made sense. On another, the idea of a person being incomplete was odd.
"Gee, show me Emperor Greyland the First."
A shimmer, and a tall, wide woman appeared and walked toward Cardenia.
"You're Emperor Greyland the First?" Cardenia asked.
"Yes,"
the woman said.
"You know what happened to you?
How you died?"
"I'm aware of the information, yes."
"How do you feel about it?" This was all an aside, but Cardenia had to know.
"I don't feel anything about it. I'm a computer simulation of a person. That said, given what I know about it, I imagine the actual Emperor Greyland I was exceptionally pissed about it."
This made Cardenia smile. Then she got back on track. "You knew the flow stream for Dalla Sisla was collapsing."
"I was given models by scientists that suggested that the stream was in danger of collapsing, yes. Given the data and my understanding of it, I thought it was possible and likely."
"But you didn't evacuate the Dalla Sisla system?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Politics,"
Greyland said.
"Evacuating the 20 million people who lived in the Dalla Sisla system would have required immense planning and capital on the part of the interdependency. There was no will for it."
"The Parliament didn't want to save the lives of 20 million people?"
"They didn't see it as a matter of saving those lives. They considered it a matter of someone they saw as a weak emperor trying to manufacture a crisis, as a way of shifting the balance of power away from the Parliament." They also saw it as a threat to trade and the economy, since a large number of ships would need to be committed to an evacuation at a huge cost.
What about the data showing the possibility of a collapse?
They held a commission, which featured other flow physicists poking holes in the findings, introducing enough doubt to undermine any political drive to do anything. Even the representatives from Dalla-Sisla voted down my recommendation to begin an evacuation. What eventually passed was a recommendation for further study. But money wasn't appropriated in the imperial budget for that further study, so nothing came of it.
So you did nothing, Cardenia was going to say, but then stopped because it would be rude and would make Greyland almost instantly defensive. Then she remembered she was talking to a computer who didn't have feelings. So you did nothing.
I sent the local Duchess an advisory and told the military and local imperial bureaucrats to assist, on an expedited basis, any Dalla-Sislans who wanted to leave.
And did they?
We don't know. The flow stream collapsed almost immediately after I sent the advisory.
So 20 million people died because of politics and bureaucracy.
Yes, not immediately, of course. But the intentional nature of the interdependency is that each system is reliant on the others for essentials. Remove one system and its ruling house a monopoly, and the dozens of other systems will survive. But that one system will not. Over time, it will begin to fail. The habitats in space and outposts on otherwise uninhabitable planets and moons will fall into disrepair, and over time will become harder to fix. Farms and food production factories will also start to fail. Social networks will break down predictably, commensurate to failures of the physical plant and the realization that ultimately nothing can save the people in the cutoff system. Between the physical and social failures that will follow the collapse of the flow stream, system-wide death is inevitable.
How long did it take?
When the Dalla-Sisla collapse happened, I ordered radio observatories in the Kaipara system to train in on Dalla-Sisla. Kaipara was the closest system by physical distance, 17 light-years away. I was dead before they heard anything.
But they heard something.
Briefly. Most in-system communication in my era was through focused streams of data, so it would have been difficult to eavesdrop randomly. When I ordered the radio telescopes to listen, I hoped someone at Dalla-Sisla would have the presence of mind to point a wide-spectrum transmitter at Kaipara. And as I understand it, someone did, for about a month, 2 years after the collapse.
What did it say?
Basically, civil war, murder, violence, sabotage of life support systems and food production, the rise of cults of personality. There's a classified report that was prepared by my son and successor, Bruno III.
Classified? Cardenia turned to Ottavio VI. Is it still classified?
I didn't unclassify it, no, Ottavio said.
Why not? Especially if you believe the flow is in danger of collapsing.
Because the problems that existed in Greyland's era exist in ours, or mine, I should say. The Parliament would still see raising the concern as a political move to marginalize them. No one wants to disrupt trade or the privileges of the guild houses. And in this case, it won't be just one system, like Dalla-Sisla. It will be all of them.
There won't be anywhere to run. What happened at Dalla-Sisla will happen everywhere. Unless I was absolutely sure, I wasn't going to open that particular box of trouble. And here is where Cardenia, in her dream, departed from her script. This is all stupid, she said to Ottavio VI and Greyland I. We're doomed only if we keep doing what we're doing. If we know a collapse is coming, we have to reform the interdependency, end the house monopolies, help every system prepare for the collapse.
It won't happen, Ottavio VI said.
You don't know that.
Of course I know that. I'm the Emperor. Or was.
Cardenia turned to Greyland I. You saw a collapse happen. In your time, they must have responded.
I was assassinated, Greyland I said. And, after a brief vogue for entertainment about the lost system of Dalla-Sisla, everyone decided to forget about it. The other flow streams looked stable, and thinking about Dalla-Sisla was inconvenient.
No one wants the interdependency to end, including the House of Wu. There's too much money and power at stake, Ottavio VI said.
And the survival of humanity doesn't matter? Cardenia asked incredulously.
Not if it means the end of the interdependency.
The survival of humanity was the point of the interdependency, Cardenia shouted at the computer simulation of her father.
And this is where, in her dream, both Ottavio VI and Greyland I laughed in her face.
My child, that's never been the point of the interdependency, Ottavio VI said.
It's just the excuse we gave for it,
Greyland I affirmed, nodding.
Then what is the point? Cardenia asked, still shouting. What is the interdependency?
And here there was another shimmer, and another figure walked toward Cardenia, a figure that Cardenia knew was meant to be Raquel I, Prophet Emperor, the legendary founder of the interdependency. It was meant to be Raquel I, but looked like Nafa. Nafa, who had been caught in the explosion of the presentation balcony. Nafa, the last sight of whom that Cardenia would ever have, was her being torn apart by the blast. Nafa, covered in blood, who stood in front of Cardenia now, as Raquel I, to tell her what the interdependency was and is. It's a scam, she said. And then Cardenia, who even dreaming could no longer pretend not to know what had happened, willed herself awake, to find herself in a bed, in her own very small, very secure private hospital, surrounded by imperial bodyguards, a phalanx of doctors led by Ki Drinan, and a small contingent of imperial guards, including the one, right there, who would tell her what she already knew, that her friend, Nafa Dolg, was dead.
Part 2. Chapter 7.
The fighting near the University of Opole had subsided enough that Mars Claremont had been able to return to his apartment in graduate housing to pack for a trip from which he would likely never return. Which did bring up the question, if you are leaving forever, what do you take with you? Mars's triage was helped by certain factors. With regard to clothing, Mars was already packed. He had enough clothes at home in Claremont that he didn't need any from his apartment in Opole. The only thing his apartment had to offer in that regard were some casual shirts with clever astrophysics comments silkscreened on them. Mars was reasonably sure he could leave those behind. The clothing he did pack was mostly neutral in color and design. His father pointed out that fashion on Hub would be so dramatically different that he would have to restock anyway. All the music, books, pictures, entertainment, and much of the personal communication that Mars treasured was stored in a thumb-sized data crypt, along with what appeared to be close to 100,000 marks of spending money, the latter accessible only through Mars's biometrics, theoretically. Mars wouldn't have to waste space on any of those. That left things, objects of sentimental value. The large majority of these sorts of objects also resided in Claremont Palace, both because that's where Mars had lived most of his life, and also because the apartment in graduate housing was ridiculously small. Of the objects that were in the apartment, Mars chose four. Two were books given to him by his father, one on his 13th standard birthday, and one when he received his doctorate. The third was an obsolete music player given to him by Vrenna, who took the player to a Green Gods concert and managed to get it signed by three of the four members of the band. The player didn't work anymore, and the Green Gods had broken up years ago, members dispersing into oblivion and or ill-advised solo careers. But he kept it to remember that time in his life, and to remind him that Vrenna, despite often being a pain in his ass as they grew up, was occasionally capable of being thoughtful and kind. The final object was a threadbare stuffed pig named Jiggy, bought for Mars on his first birthday by his mother, who had given Vrenna a stuffed bear named Howie at the same time. Howie had disappeared years before. There was reason to believe Vrenna may have launched him into the sky using a homemade rocket, but Jiggy survived and accompanied Mars to every new home. Fiction would dictate that Jiggy was the sole remaining gift Mars had from his now departed mother. But in real life, Mars had many gifts and owned many things that were either from her or reminded him of her. Jiggy was simply his good luck charm. Mars stuffed all four objects in a small rucksack and then considered the rucksack. Not a lot to leave a world with, he thought. Mars had been doing his best not to think too much about the fact that he was leaving the planet to go to a place where he knew no one and where he would likely spend all the rest of his life. The flow stream to end would last longer than the one going out from it. It might be open for years yet. Theoretically, it was possible at this point that he could make it back. It was just deeply unlikely. Mars's way of dealing with the fact he'd never see his father or sister or any of the people he'd ever known in his lifetime was to think about the practical issues of leaving the planet, which he had attended to. The day before, he'd met with Gazan Magnoot, the chief purser of a ship called Yes Sir, That's My Baby, and arranged passage. It hadn't been cheap. It had, in fact, cost more money than Mars figured he'd ever spent on everything else he'd ever bought in his life up to that point. And Magnoot had tried to upsell him on several other things, including a faked set of travel documents. Mars noted Magnoot seemed mildly disappointed when he pointed out his travel documents were in order. With that taken care of, all that remained was to set up resignation and farewell letters, all of which would be sent after the Yes Sir was in the flow. And this, the collecting of important objects. Everything else in the apartment could be collected by Claremont staff later. Mars swung the rucksack over his shoulder, took a last look at the apartment, and decided that he would not miss it at all. It was, like nearly every academic institutional residence, entirely forgettable in every way. Then he headed down the stairs and out of the dormitory, down a street that was almost entirely empty except for a couple of people far down the road, and the van, which drove up to where Mars was, and opened up to reveal a couple of very large men. The van then took off again, Mars in it because the very large men had jumped out and dragged him into it before he really knew what was going on. The rucksack with all the sentimental objects stayed behind on the sidewalk, because sometimes that happens when you get kidnapped. Granny Nohama Peaton smiled at Mars Claremont across a small table.
Lord Mars, so good to see you again. I'm glad we could have this meeting on short notice.
Lord Granny, Mars said, since you had me kidnapped to be here, I don't think it was something I could really refuse.
The two of them were sitting in a windowless room that looked like it had been made out of a storage container, which meant it probably was a storage container, repurposed. Mars had no idea of its location. He'd been in the room all of 10 minutes, placed there by the thugs who had grabbed him, before Granny arrived.
I don't like the word kidnapped, Granny said.
With all due respect, Lord Granny, at the moment I don't really give a damn what you like.
Fair enough.
Granny leaned back in his chair and considered Mars.
Rumor is that you're planning to leave End behind.
If I were, I don't see how it's any of your business.
Well, see. There's a war on, and the Duke has noticed that several of his nobles, or their children, adult or otherwise, are now suddenly trying to book passage off the planet.
That will happen when there's a war.
I suppose it might, Granny agreed.
The Duke doesn't see it as a vote of confidence in his leadership skills, however. So, he's been inviting those who are interested in leaving to stay.
I don't think you've kidnapped me to extend me this invitation, Lord Granny, Mars said.
No, I suppose that would be going the long way around to do it.
You're correct. I've invited you here for other reasons entirely.
You'll recall the other day when I asked your father to assist the Duke with the release of Imperial funds. I recall him telling you maybe. He did. Which I took to mean no, but politely. And to be clear, if that really was his answer, his reasons were both ethically and legally sound. It was a good choice for him to make for those reasons. I'll tell him he said that. I don't doubt that you would, Granny said. Just not yet. The problem with your father's answer, legally and ethically admirable as it might be, is that right now the Duke really needs that money, because he really needs those weapons. And even maybe doesn't work with the time frame we're under. So where persuasion didn't work, compulsion might. You're holding me for ransom. Yes, and I do apologize for that. Your father isn't susceptible to other blandishments that I or the Duke might offer. He doesn't seem interested in money or power or anything else tangible, and he has no patriotism for him or loyalty to the Duke. But there's no doubt that he loves both you and your sister. From there, it was just the matter of choosing which of the two of you to pick. We considered your sister. Mars laughed at this, and Granny, as gracefully as possible, acknowledged the laugh. But she presented problems in terms of acquisition. You mean that she would have gutted the thugs you sent after her and then would have come after you next, after they gave you up? That's exactly what I mean. You were, and I mean this with no disrespect whatsoever, the softer target. Mars nodded at this. It was true enough. He was a scientist, and Vrenna was a soldier, or had been before she had taken over Claremont's constabulary. Of the two of them, he was much more likely to be taken by surprise, or rather less likely to snap anyone's neck. There is also the matter that you are intended to leave the planet, and she's not. So? You've never left End before. You've never even gone to the Imperial Station, even when your sister was in the Marines. Your leaving now is interesting. You mentioned there was a war going on. Yes, but I don't think that's why you're leaving. If you were leaving because of the war, it wouldn't just be you. Your sister and father would be leaving as well, or at least trying to. But it's just you. Granny reached into his pocket and pulled out a data crypt, laid it on the table. And by this, at least, you're not leaving with the family inheritance. Mars stared at the data crypt. It had been taken from him when he'd been kidnapped, along with the other personal items that were on his body, rather than in the now-missing rucksack. Granny pushed it over to him. Take it. Mars took it, put it in his pocket. Is it empty? No, I don't need your pictures and music, and I'm afraid the Duke needs more than 100,000 marks from your family. Until and unless your father helps us, it's not as if you're going anywhere anyway. And because I think he wants you to go now, I think we'll get what we want from him. And if you don't? Granny shrugged. For starters, you're not leaving the planet. For starters? The Duke really needs access to that money. Enough to kill me? He wouldn't be killing you himself. But now that you mention it, at the moment, hundreds and possibly thousands of people are dying daily in this stupid rebellion. If placing one life in the balance, yours, means thousands more will live, isn't that a risk worth taking? You really just attempted to morally justify kidnapping me. Granny shrugged again. It's certainly an argument I can see the Duke making to ease his conscience. Whether it holds water is not something I think he'll trouble himself with. The Duke is many things, but a great thinker is not one of them. This isn't going to work. We'll see. Either way, war excuses many lapses, especially if the Duke gets his weapons and quashes the rebellion. In the meantime, Lord Mars, You get to find out how much you are worth to your father. If not for yourself, then for whatever reason he has for sending you off the planet. You don't want to tell me what that is, do you? It's not any of your business. I know you believe that, but you might be surprised at the scope of my business. Since the scope of your business clearly involves kidnapping, I don't think anything you do